against artists and art, his classic American immigration experience, and how WikiLeaks, Manning, and Snowden fit into the global struggle for free speech. That's Salman Rushdie this Friday at 11 a.m., online at kboo.fm and on your community radio station, KBOO.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Merrillhurst University, dedicated to helping adults revitalize their careers by offering 5 part-time MBAs, including the Green MBA in Sustainable Business and the MBA in Healthcare Management. Evening, weekend, and online classes allow students to keep days free for work and other commitments, enrolling now for winter and spring terms. Also, thanks to the Clinton Street Theater, featuring independent and revival films, the Rocky Horror Picture Show every Saturday at midnight, as well as the monthly KBOO Movie Night. The Clinton Street Theater is located at the corner of Southeast Clinton and 26th in Portland. Schedule and information at 503-238-5588 or cstpdx.com.
Good morning and welcome to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host. Today's guest, Veronica Gonzalez-Pena, is a novelist, filmmaker, editor, and founder of Rocky Point Press, a series of artist-writer collaborations. Her first novel, Twin Time or How Death Befell Me, won the 2007 Aslan Prize for Emerging Chicano Writers. Her work has also appeared in Black Clock, Animal Shelter, The Mississippi Review, and New World Young Latino Writers. Veronica Gonzalez-Pena is here today on Between the Covers to talk about The Sad Passions, her new novel from Semiotext. Set in the Mexico City of the 1960s and 70s, The Sad Passions is told by 6 women narrators who circle the mystery of family, love, and madness. The Los Angeles Review of Books describes it as follows. The Sad Passions explodes the tired assumption that women's interiority is intrinsically domestic. It fans out women's inner lives like the vibrant sections of a peacock's tail, upending our expectations of a novel about women's family life. The cumulative effect is a hall of mirrors, an intimate, personal hall of mirrors, a psychic hall of mirrors. This, she tells us, is where women live, how women live, in the company of past selves, future selves, in the anguished haunting of possible selves. Welcome to Between the Covers, Veronica Gonzalez-Pena.
Thank you, David. It's great to be here.
The Sad Passions is the story of one family told by 6 members of it. Can you introduce us a little bit to the family that you explore in The Sad Passions?
I guess the place that it all fans out from would be Claudia. She's the mother in this story, and she's mad, though the girls, her daughters, the other characters don't know it when they're growing up. They live in the turmoil of the fanning out of her own psychic reality. The other characters are, 4 of them are her daughters. Rocio, who is the oldest daughter, and she's probably a typical oldest child. She's the one that wants to fix things and mend, and that sees all the breakage while at the same time being very vague and unsure in herself and in what she's seen. So she falls in and out of an incredible lucidity, which through which we follow her. And we ourselves, when we're with Rocio, seem to go in and out of that lucidity. The next daughter is Julia. And Julia gets given away when she's 7 years old, almost 7 years old. And she goes to live with an uncle in the United States and becomes an art historian. Julia's perspective of this family is quite different from the other girls because she's grown up in a different world. She's incredibly sensitive and very internal. Her sections, I would say, are the most internal in the book. The next daughter is Marta, and Marta is really the wild one. It's surprising to me, but Marta's the character that most people want to know more about. She's extravagant in many ways in her selfness, and she's the person that spills out and maybe writes and is written by her mother's madness most clearly. She reacts in violent ways and is reacted upon in violent ways, I would say. The youngest daughter is Sandra. And Sandra is a poet, although she's not quite aware of it yet. She's really has a different kind of lucidity than Rocio. She moved through the world in a magical way and understands things at a kind of a magical level, and feels the closest connection with her sister Julia, who has been given away. She's also something of an amateur historian, so it's through her that we really get to see Mexico City and to understand some of the layering of history that we get from the book. The last voice, which only appears once in the book, these are all first-person narratives, by the way, and they're all quite interwoven. The last voice is Claudia's sister, so the aunt of these other characters. And she appears once very briefly toward the center of the book, and she's a character who turns everything upside down for us, I think. We've been getting this series of narratives and this very strong voice, which is Claudia's voice. And she comes in and turns everything that Claudia has said upside down for us so that we doubt and have to rethink everything that's come before and perhaps see everything that comes after she appears a little bit differently. We start reading the book differently because of her presence, I think. She's quite an important character, even though she only appears for that tiny little section.
And when you discuss the undercutting of one person's narrative by another, it brings up the issue of the choices you made around the structure of the book to not tell it in a linear narrative style, but to sort of circle around the mysteries of the family from various perspectives. And I would love to hear more about that choice and how you feel like it informs the project that you're doing with The Sad Passions.
Well, I'm incredibly interested in point of view, and this book would have been very, very easy or much easier to tell if it were a kind of a close third person rendition of these people's lives. And I had a moment where somebody suggested that I do that, and I had a moment of thinking that I would, just because that's a much easier voice for me to play with. I mean, it was actually one of my editors at Semiotext, Teddy L. Colty, who's a very important person to me and to my writing, who said that I should always push myself. And I knew that this would be difficult, but I knew that it would be the thing that would challenge me as a writer. So it's these essentially five first person narrations, with this sixth one appearing once, and they are quite interwoven. And one of the things that I love about that kind of structure is that it allows for this deferred understanding. It allows for things to unfold for the reader in the way that things unfold for a consciousness, in the way that things unfold for me in my life or for you in your life, where you will see something differently because of something that has occurred later. So it's this idea of deferred understanding, and which is a kind of a Freudian psychoanalytic idea, that new information or a new bit some new occurrence will turn everything that you think you know upside down. And I think that for a work of art, that's a very kind of, it's a difficult place for a reader because you never quite know where your footing is. But I also feel like it's an extremely exciting place for a reader because you are in process as you're reading the book. Everything is constantly electric and happening and becoming unraveled as it's raveling. And I think that for me, the experience of telling that way has very much to do with my relationship to the reader and my desire that the reader be involved in that kind of internal psychic kind of motion.
It's also a great match for that feeling as a child of not having all the information and trying to figure out what's going on, which I think would be true in any family, but it's particularly true in this one when you have a mentally ill mother who is sometimes very there, but erratically so, and sometimes very absent. But same thing with the father who's unpredictable. Like, sometimes he appears and sometimes he disappears. Mm-hmm. And then the mystery, the central mystery, of why the mother gave away one of her children, which of course is something that's haunting all of the children in the family about this alternate reality.
Yeah. most of the book is these memories, these childhood memories, these memories that these girls have. So the perspective is this childlike kind of very kind of vague and diffuse relationship to knowledge and to information that we do have when we're children. But I think that we have that relationship to knowledge throughout our lives. There's always that kind of thing is constantly happening to us. I think we feel it most acutely when we're children. But I, as an adult, am constantly re-understanding things or gaining a different perspective on something that I thought I knew. And I think that, for me, that is so closely related to this idea of process and motion and the flow of understanding in life, which I take up. And I think that's really the central kind of drive in all of my work is to think about process and motion and to create it in a narrative in a way that a reader falls into that space where it's almost immersive, that sense of process.
Well, Claudia, the mother who is mentally ill, you mentioned the one chapter that's narrated by her sister as really undercutting her narrative, but also I would be interested to hear you talk about your considerations about portraying mental illness. I felt like the choices you made around narration, about giving her a voice in the book rather than just having it told by the children, was also crucial, because we get the children mystified by her behavior, confused, and yet when we hear her narrate, she's a very different person than what we experience from people observing her from the outside. Mm-hmm. And I felt like that also undercuts narrative too in an interesting way, because mm-hmm. you give her her humanity in those sections when she's speaking. And I wondered if there was any trepidation or concern around how to portray the mental illness in an appropriate way in the book.
Those sections, I have to say, were incredibly difficult for me to write. They were extremely draining. The book as a whole was very, very difficult because it's so internal, and I had to kind of occupy these different voices. But it was very difficult for me to do that voice. I know people who are mentally ill quite intimately, and it did feel like a big responsibility. And I wanted to make sure that my portrayal was an empathic, open, loving portrayal overall. I'm not really sure how I stumbled upon the technique, which ended up working for me, which is that she starts out, her sections generally start out fairly lucid, and then she gets herself into these rhythms that kind of take control of her, like the rhythm of her language and the rhythm of her unraveling becomes bigger than her selfness by the end of her chapters. And I think that from my experience of people who have the illness that Claudia is meant to have, I see that happening in just general conversations, where a conversation can start in one place and you think that things are one thing, and by the end of even a small conversation, things can unravel. And once they start unraveling, it happens very, very quickly, and it just kind of plummets from there. So I think that for me was at least something that I could hang myself on as I was writing these sections. I needed something because it was very difficult and quite draining, as I say. But overall, I felt like I had to give her a voice, and I wanted to give her... I didn't want to whitewash anything, but I wanted to give her her humanity and give an empathic view of what her interiority might be like and the terror that she herself feels in the face of the unraveling.
In case you just tuned in, you're listening to Between the Covers, and we're talking today to writer Veronica Gonzalez-Pena about her novel, The Sad Passions. You've said in another interview, Veronica, that the phenomenon of the nuclear family wasn't something prominent in Mexico in the 60s and 70s, and that this more fluid, shifting definition of family you saw as more forgiving, like creating more room for mistakes and for variant personalities, and consequently also that the concept of madness was more fluid in Mexico at that time period. Could you talk a little bit more about that and how it informs the choices you make about the portrayal of this family?
Yeah, I don't know that it's consequent that mental illness was seen differently because of these kinds of family structures. What I do know is that these family structures were more forgiving, or are more forgiving in terms of a person's mental illness. There's a larger web, and that web is there for everything. There's just a larger web of to hold any individual up. I think that the idea of a nuclear family, it puts an awful lot of pressure on all of the people within that unit. The parents have to be everything to the children, and the children have to be everything to the parents. And in these kind of larger structures, there's a lot more room for mistakes. There are three or four different models of what it is to be a woman in a household where their aunts and grandmother are present, or what to be a man when the uncles are present, or what a father might look like when these people, all of these different people, are present. And there's a lot more places for a child to move through and between, and the fluidity that it allows, I think, is quite forgiving and quite beautiful. I think that the way that affects this thing, which we'll call mental illness, is that it allows for a lot more places for that to kind of go and be held. The strict kind of characterizations and graphings and institutionalizing of all of these things, it's just not a part of that culture in the way that it is here. There are things that are there are negative sides to it. I'm not being Pollyanna-ish about it at all, but I think that it is generally more forgiving for the person that has the illness.
And certainly in this family, there are many generations who are raised by someone other than their parents.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Claudia is, yeah. And then yeah. Also she gives away one of her children to be raised by someone else in the family as well.
Yeah, yeah. But she's being raised by someone in the family, which happens a lot in Latin America. My Latin American and Asian friends actually kind of understand that kind of structure, that an aunt or uncle would take a child in. It's not surprising to them in the way that my other friends are kind of shocked by.
Sure.
Because of these larger family structures that are prevalent in both of those cultures, I think.
Well, let's have our listeners hear a little bit of the prose from The Sad Passions.
Okay, so I'm going to read from Julia's section. This is a Julia, who is the daughter who has been given away. And as I said, all of the sections are first-person narration. So this is from her point of view. And each chapter is just headed with the person's name. So I'll just read a couple pages of Julia. This is the first time she speaks, by the way. Julia. It's not to say that things were always terrible. They weren't. Most of the time they weren't, and I was happy. Lots of people around me, aunts and cousins and friends, my grandmother. We would eat together often, all of us, big meals prepared by the housekeeper. My grandmother, the sole adult in that house, really, her children all still in their 20s and continually rushing back to her home after the always futile attempt of a few months out on their own. Worked her job at the National Palace, so was gone most of the day, every day, and on weekends loved to play cards, poker for small change. Her glasses on, deep concentration, a cigarette in her mouth, three fingers tapping, everything flowing in and out of her, and she herself focused on her hand. So that every week there was a parade of folks streaming through the house, old people mostly, but often with children or grandchildren in tow, so that they weren't always uninteresting to us, those card games. My grandmother laughing and joking and sipping wine or coffee and picking at olives or nuts or dried fruit which somebody had brought. We would play too sometimes, piles of change in front of us, scheming, trying our hardest to cheat, never really knowing if they were letting us win or not. These nights were for staying up late, for running in groups through the house and all of its secret insides. The rooms of our uncles and aunt, full of candles and little bottles holding tonics and perfumes and dark-colored paintings and drawers stuffed with treasures which we dared to open only once or twice. And then we'd go outside, to the little enclosed garden which transformed into dim, unpredictable wilderness in the dark of night, the bunch of us planning and hiding and spying, peeking through windows, trying to get at hints of what it was that drove the adults' unpredictable lives. Sometimes a group of my estranged father's friends would show up for those card games too, though he was rarely with them, and they were thrilling to us, young and handsome like he was, in skinny black suits and thin ties, and even back then we could tell they were serious in their gambling, though in my grandmother's presence, out of respect for her, they held back. There was one. He was tall and had light-colored hair, was often in the center, the others orbiting around him, and this one would occasionally send gifts meant only for me, not for my sisters, but for me. And we never thought to question the apparent injustice of this. We were used to inequality, though for a long time it remained fuzzily unclear. It wouldn't be until I was older, 13 or so, that I would come to understand what was driving those visits, driving those just-for-me gifts.
You mention in this reading the estranged father and his friends who sometimes pop into the narrative and then disappear again. Tell us about the choice and the sad passions to narrate it exclusively from the female perspective, why you made that choice, and the effect you were going for by really foregrounding a female narrative and having the men be more peripheral or marginal to it.
Well, I'm very much into female narratives. I'm very shaped by women writers and women's interiority. And I think that, well, Mexico is quite matriarchal, even though it doesn't look like it. The men are also macho and, you know, present in this kind of large way. But at least in the home, what happens in the homes is very, very centered on women. And so because this is largely a book about that kind of, about interiority and about that space, the space of the home, that's what comes out. But the men actually write a lot of this story, even though they're not present. So the grandfather, who is not present very often, much of what happens is written by the fact that he leaves, that he abandons his family and goes off to live with another woman, and leaves the grandmother kind of to pull everything together and to struggle along. And the same happens in Claudia's life, where the husband is not present, but he very much writes himself upon her and the girls' lives. He's the first person that takes her to have electroshock therapy. He's very present, but is only told through these perspectives, mm-hmm. I think. And I like the fact that I've written a book that is all women, and that that it's these very varied and various perspectives of what it is to be a woman. Yeah.
I really like the effect too. And it's interesting. I feel like in the last third of the Sad Passions, even though we continue to have the narration by women, we start to get more of an understanding of the men. And I liked that effect of specifically the chapter when Julia narrates as if from the perspective of her father, which yeah. I found very moving. And then we also start to learn about the mysterious other lives of Uncle Felix and his past around making art. And we learn about the father of the daughters who lives now in Veracruz, and also about first sexual experiences. And all this starts to amass in the last third of the book about confronting men and maleness, but you've already established this very strong center of gravity around the female narrative and interiority before we go there. It's a very interesting move that the Sad Passions makes, I think.
Oh, yeah, thank you. That section where Julia speaks as if from the voice of her, of who she finds out is her biological father. It starts out with those incredible images by Hans Bellmer, and with her talking about Hans Bellmer too. So that kind of the male's action upon the females, the way that the male can act upon the female, begins that whole section. And then it's interesting because that gets turned upside down when she speaks from the point of view of the man. So she takes what Bellmer's done basically and turns it upside down and speaks for the man.
For our listeners who might not be familiar with him, with his art,
with
Hans Bellmer, could you maybe touch a little bit on what purpose he's playing in the narrative and his Julia's relationship to his art?
Yeah, I guess I this gives me the opportunity to just say a little bit about the images that I use in the book.
Yeah.
My decision to use images in the book came quite late in the process. I felt I was done with the book and was about to hand it in when it hit me that there might be a lot of people that wouldn't pick up on the references to the different artists. And so in Julia's section, I include some of the artists that she's speaking about. I include images from them. And generally, in the earlier sections, there's several artists. But in the later sections, she concentrates on one artist for each chapter. And the first one is Hans Bellmer, and the second is Francesca Woodman. She does an essay about each of these artists. So you get some of the background in the book. But Hans Bellmer was an artist practicing before the Second World War. And he made these puppets. They're images that we are all quite familiar with now, but that were quite shocking at the time, I think. He made these life-size puppets that were these female puppets, and they're quite mutilated female puppets, and he has them sometimes partially dressed, but always in these very enticing kind of sexual ways. He has puppets with no limbs. He has puppets with a dual vaginas, where the head is a vagina with legs coming out of it. He has puppets that he hangs from trees so that they're like either suicided or murdered. They're incredibly disturbing poupées.
And one of the things that I think is the creepiest thing for me in watching them is his own presence in the background, often blurry and observing his creations.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, I used those images. I use a couple of images where he's present once hidden behind a tree, and another time as this kind of spectral image in this double exposure. And it was important for me, especially in that section, which is all about fathers, to have, he's essentially the father of these puppets, and to have him present at the mangling, dismemberment, and suicide of all of these different women, these different women puppets that he creates, that the father may be writing these events upon the bodies of his creation. It's thematically written into the book. It just fit perfectly for what I was doing in the writing.
And can you
writing.
Talk about the theme of ghost fathers in The Sad Passions, which this sort of resonates off mm-hmm. of the larger theme of the ghostliness of the men in the book, really?
Well, I think we just spoke about it a little bit, that these fathers are there and not there. And the book is largely about absence. And Julia is... It's clear for us that Julia is that. She's the one who is and is not there. Her voice is very strong. She's the person that we as a reader probably relate to most closely because she's intellectual, she's very subtle, she's very sensitive, like all of us readers are. So we identify with her, but she's also the person that isn't there, and she's the site of a lot of the anxiety and tension for that family. She's really... there's a point where Sandra calls her the stain. She's the stain for the rest of the family. She's the thing that they're trying to make up for, that they're trying to contend with. And that's a clear absence, the story of Julia. But there's a secondary absence, which is the absence of all of the men in these lives. they end up being these ghost fathers. And I think one of the things that is interesting to me about absence is how present and how we get written by absence, how really present absence is. That absence isn't the lack of the existence of something. It's the lack of the thing that we want or that we long for. And that's very clear in this book, that the absence is the thing that creates this unfillable void in this huge longing, which I think the book conveys quite well by the end of it.
In case you just tuned in, you're listening to Between the Covers, and we're talking today to writer Veronica Gonzalez-Pena about her novel, The Sad Passions. Well, that idea of there and not there is also brought out with the repeating motif of doppelgangers or twinning. We have Julia, who's given away, but then we have Sandra, who opens the book, who feels haunted by Julia's absence. They look a lot alike, like each other, and she feels weirdly like she's replaced her in the family system in some strange way. Yeah. But we also have Claudia, the mother's story of her father and him being in love when he was a kid with one of two twins who dies in a house fire. And then he goes on to only love one of his daughters.
Right.
And similarly, we have the story of the hummingbirds where two hummingbirds hit the window pane, and one it gets up and flies away and the other one dies. Yeah. It reminds me of a feminine version of all of those biblical stories, yeah. You know, Jacob and Esau and Isaac and Ishmael,
yeah.
Abel and Cain.
Yeah.
And it's very fascinating, the twinning aspect of The Sad Passions. Can you talk a little bit more about that, the doppelganger aspect of the book?
Well, I'm clearly fascinated by twins. My first book is called Twin Time. I think that doubling... It's fascinating because doubling can never really be doubling, right? It's the thing that approaches, but that can never be. And so there's all of this work to approach and to attempt to make an attempt at something that can't ever quite be what it's attempting to be. And so for Sandra in the book, we know they look alike. We know they look more alike than any of the other sisters, she and Julia. But we're not quite sure they look that much alike. It could just be Sandra's seeing it that way, her need and her desire to see it that way. And again, we get very deeply into the psychology of the character who's speaking. Is she really that closely aligned to her sister? Is this something that she needs to have for herself? And if she needs to have it, what is it in her that drives that need to be like this missing sister? Is it, you know, sometimes we're driven not by a desire that is going to end well, but by a desire that could kill us. That's the death drive. And could it be that Sandra is pushing toward the thing that's most painful, which is to become this absent sister, the thing that she can't quite believe is real and is the thing that she feels the need to fill in through herself. So she becomes the filling in of the void. And we're never quite sure what is happening externally when we hear Sandra speak, because she's so internal and so poetic, and the poetry and magic of her world takes over when she's speaking. We're never quite sure what we're getting from her and how real it is. Doubling for me is fascinating because of that, because it's the thing that is going after something that it can't have, and that intense drive for that thing is what moves me. What is it that drives that need to be someone else?
It creates that ghostly haunting quality in the book too.
Yeah.
I think, and it brings me to the presence of Mexico specifically, because I feel like you portray Mexico. I think Mexico serves a purpose of doubling in the book. The some of the issues in the family, but also this idea of haunting, both in the family around the doubles, but also the haunting of Mexico's history, because it's, you know, Mexico City literally being built on a drained lake where all of the Aztec canals used to be, and the rocks of these Aztec monuments still being present in the city, and the way in which the past is sort of haunting the present of the actual physicality of Mexico City feels very much like it's twinning with the family system that's going on.
Yeah, where it's twinning with the family system and twinning with itself, right? But Mexico's twinning is twinning with itself. It's the present that is written through the architecture of the past. The city center is built upon the old temples and the very rocks of the National Palace and all of the civic buildings, it's a very beautiful center, and this Zócalo, which is as I say, the second largest public square in the world after Tiananmen Square. It's all built with the very rocks of the temples that were there before. And there's something very magical about especially that part of Mexico City, where the history is. There's really a tripling of the history, because we have the colonial, and then we have the modern right there as well. But there's something phantasmagoric about it. It's very ghostly and present. And there's a sense that things are always there. That when the places hold things, and the things can't be disappeared. Which is one of the driving forces of the book as well. That even though Julia is sent away, she becomes this driving force for the family. And I think that that's something to think about in terms of the history of Mexico as well. That even as it was attempted to quash it out, it's there and it's bubbling and it's gurgling. And
it seems so radically different than the United States approach to its past, in the sense that, I mean, even the native mythology is reflected in the flag. It's reflected in the great muralists of Mexico. It's very much present in the national narrative, along with what the conquistadors brought.
Well, I think that it's the difference between the Catholic and the Protestant. The Protestant is largely an I, and for the Catholic is a. The way that it conquers is by embracing everyone and making everyone a part of the fold. And so I think that if you're going to conquer through embracing, then everyone has to feel like they're a part of it, right? Mm. Which model is better if you're a conqueror? I don't know. I think that here things were quashed out, and then, you know, we're quite successful at pretending that history doesn't exist in America. We're very good at it. We're very good at the here and now, here and now, here and now, all the time. Whereas in Mexico, there's still this sense of layering, and people are very involved in their own history in Mexico, and yeah, it does feel quite different, the relationship to place and to time there than it does here. I think it has something to do with just different models for occupying and conquering.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about New Orleans and Louisiana, yeah, as the one sort of Catholic,
yeah,
bastion of the United States, yeah, it has really incorporated its past.
Yeah,
in a,
yeah,
way the rest of the United, yeah, States hasn't.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that there's a connection, clearly. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. In case you just tuned in, we're talking today to Veronica Gonzalez Pena about her novel, The Sad Passions. Maybe this is a good time to talk about the title, The Sad Passions. What does that mean?
It comes from Spinoza, and it comes from something that I read in Deleuze's book on Spinoza, where he's talking about this categorization. Spinoza's kind of the Thomas Aquinas of the emotions. He categorizes and explains the emotions. And the sad passions are the passions or the emotions which keep you from being active in your own life. So so that you're reacting instead of acting. And that, of course, we all know can get quite complicated, where we don't know that we're reacting when we are. We think we're acting, but actually we're acting in reaction to what our father did or what our mother did or what something that happened that we don't even remember. And so those passions are things like longing or hatred or sadness itself, self-abnegation. There's a long list of what these reactionary emotions or passions are that keep us from moving forward in the world. I think that in the novel, I had someone who's actually a psychoanalyst ask me if I felt that there was any possibility for any of the girls, if there was any hope in the book. And I think that there is. I think that two of the characters in the book may be able to move through these sad passions into something else, into something that feels more kind of active and an active way of being in the world and living. And I refused to tell her who they were, and I'm going to refuse here as well, because I think people should read the book and try and figure it out. But I think that it's a very dark book. It can be quite scary. But I think that there is this seed of hope in that idea that there may be some motion through these passions.
I felt that very clearly by the end.
Oh, you did? Good.
I did.
Oh, good.
The shift around Hans Bellmer, who we mm-hmm. talked about, mm-hmm. and then the interpretation of Francesca Woodman at the end, which felt like a very hopeful and active ending with a sense of agency for a couple of the characters.
Yeah,
at
yeah.
the end.
Yeah, yeah, I hope so. I mean, I hope so. I hope that's what it turns into for them.
Well, maybe we could talk a little bit about
excuse me. I have a bit of a cold.
That's okay. So I want to talk a little bit about Francesca Woodman and what she means to the book, because she graces the cover of the book with an incredibly indelible photograph, but also Julia's relationship to Francesca Woodman. I mean, it's the perfect photographer for the book, both around the fact that she uses a doppelganger herself. Her best friend is often a stand-in for herself in her photography, that she's creating these spectral, ghostly images of women. But it feels like Julia really comes around to seeing her photographs, as haunting as they are, to be somewhat hopeful herself, which made me feel hopeful for Julia, or at least they felt active, like in comparison to the dismembering dolls of Hans Bellmer. This felt like the flip side. Like, it felt like taking the agency back.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's very different when a woman acts upon her own body than when a man acts upon a woman's body, right? If it were a woman making those Hans Bellmer dolls, I would feel very differently about them. It's remarkable when you write anything, even a short piece, but certainly when you write a novel, something that takes years to do, when things seem to come together, where it seems almost as if things are being given to you as a gift, or as if the novel was always intended to be exactly in this way. And it was in the moment that I decided to use images, that as I was looking through images, it was remarkable how closely, because the book was already written, how closely some of the images that I decided to use fit the narrative. There's that one image of Francesca Woodman and two other girls, and then the spectral missing image, which is in the book, and you'll have to get the book and look at that image. If you don't have it, but that it was almost as if that image had been made for the novel. It was really phenomenal. I think you've said a lot of what the feeling is around Francesca Woodman already, which is that there is such absence and desire and longing, and they're incredibly moving and melancholic. Even when they're being playful, the images are incredibly melancholic and without the kind of sappiness of a lot of really young art, you know.
There's definitely none of that.
There's none of that, which is incredible, because she, you know, these were, a lot of them were student photographs, and there's none of that in her work, which is just remarkable given her age and where she was
in terms of her career and discovering herself. It's just kind of remarkable. But I think that for the book, that sense of absence, even in the cover, there's often furniture which suggests the presence of someone that's not there, or there's these spectral images which are these double exposures, or there's a lot of stuff that happens in graveyards and a lot of the doubling of an insertion of other people as herself. And it's like that her work is kind of circling around the book, or that the book is circling around her work, perhaps. Yeah, yeah. And Julia does a nice read of her work, I believe.
Yeah, she really does.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Well, back to the title for a minute. And you're talking about the sad passions, the passions that are reactive passions that weaken us rather than empower us. I think Deleuze was saying that those passions are used by despots and priests to control the people following them, essentially. But in this book, it feels like the sad passions are coming almost from, instead of some sort of totalitarian system, but from the absence of any sort of rules. Like the absence of parenting feels like is what is bringing out the sad passions in this book. And I wonder if that feels right to you.
Well, I don't think the sad passions come from a kind of despotic rule. I think that we all have them in ourselves. And there's a way in which we can all go to that place, and that they get utilized by despots. And I think that here, those things are there, and they're there strongly because of a lack of any centering. There's no centering for these girls. You know, when a parent is completely absent or mad, which maybe is even worse than absent because it's erratic. There's nothing to center the girls. There's no kind of guiding principle for finding a different way of moving through the world, or they're always going to be in reaction to the lack. You know, there's a huge empty hole in the middle. Mm-hmm. So I guess maybe that's our initial absence, right? The absence of the mother. And they're always going to be in reaction to that lack. How can they write themselves in reaction to something that's missing?
Well, when you step back and look at the family history, yeah, as we get more of near the end of the book, yeah, we see a lot of people in the family who have artistic impulses that, yeah, they're not able to fulfill, yeah, for one reason, yeah, or another. We have Uncle Felix, and then, yeah, we have Claudia herself, the mother, both wanting to be artists,
yeah,
and either not being encouraged or for whatever reason the circumstances weren't conducive. And I'm wondering if the two people who feel like the artists who fulfill themselves as artistic temperaments in the book are Julia and Sandra.
Yeah.
I mean, Julia literally becoming an artist, but Sandra has this sort of artistic synesthetic view of the world, it feels like to me. Yeah. And I wondered if that was because they were the ones that could both step outside of the family. They're in Mexico and in other places. So yeah, they're able to cultivate this observer mind to the,
yeah,
system.
Yeah.
And similarly, Julia is able to imagine her father's life. Like she has the capacity to step into another consciousness and imagine it, which feels like it's because she's not fully there. I mean, she's there and not there in the family. And so, right, maybe that was, I wonder if that space is what's allowing these two women, contrary to Claudia, who has never had that space,
yeah,
could actually fulfill their artistic impulses.
Yeah, and I guess I was going to kind of mention that earlier when we were talking about Francesca Woodman, that one of the ways that you become active is through taking whatever you've been handed and turning it into something. You know, the ability to take things and then turn them into art. That's a very active process. That I think is what I think we're answering the question of who these two characters are. But I think that is the thing that offers these two characters a way out. And maybe it's, as you say, they were out to begin with anyway. There is this sense in which artists are outsiders and have to be outsiders, that in order to view, you have to be outside enough to view. And that, of course, is like the the pain of being an artist, right? You always feel on the fringes of things, and maybe not quite in the center, if we're talking in those ways. But it also gives you the space within which to create, and you have to be able to take chances in order to be an artist. There has to be, you have to be distant enough that you will take chances that other people won't take out of fear or, well, fear. I mean, that's the big one, right? Why would you not do things? It would be fear. Yeah. Yeah.
So what are some of the influences or inspirations that you felt played a role in the Sad Passions coming to being?
In terms of books and people that I read, or?
Well, it could be books. I know that you do artist-writer collaborations, and this book is both visual and text. So it wouldn't necessarily have to be books. But I was curious if you, as you were creating the Sad Passions, if you were also going places for inspiration or tapping into other artistic work as a source.
A couple of years ago, I was reading Eileen Miles's book Inferno, and there's this one section in that book where she talks about being, I think it's in Pennsylvania, where she's staying at someone's house, and she talks about getting up in the morning and going for a run with her dog and then coming home and write. And like, that was an incredibly productive time for her, and it's like one of her happiest, most productive periods. And at that point, I thought, oh my God, because I run, and I thought, running can be part of my process. Like, this is a part of what I do, and I really made it a part of my process. And then I thought, well, everything is a part of my process. Like, it wasn't that same day that I thought that, but over time I thought, everything that I do is a part of my process. So I do see a lot of art, and I see a lot of film, and I read like we all do, and I think everything that I'm doing as I'm working on a book ends up informing what I end up doing. Now, there are there are people that I go back to again and again and again, and every time I start a new piece, I go back to H.D.'s The Gift, and I read Virginia Woolf a lot, and I read Henry James a lot, and Jean Rhys, especially Wide Sargasso Sea, that just the rhythm of the language in that. When I decided to put images in the book, I thought, why only Sebald? Why only him? Why is he the only one that's allowed to do that? And so I asked my publisher, I asked the people at Semiotext, and they said yes. And that seemed very important to me in terms of this book. And
it really does add a lot to the book.
Yeah.
To have the images there.
Yeah, imagine it without the images. It would be a different book, yeah. And of course I love his work. But I think I couldn't even begin to talk about the different things that I've seen in the last couple of years or in the years that I was working on the book, but all of it, my conversations with people, you know, my conversations certainly with the people at Semiotext, dinners. When I lived in LA, I would have a lot of dinners, and I think of, you know, my friendships are like collaborations. It's all, and that's, you know, this Rocky Point project, which is a collab, these artistic collaborations that I put together and that I sometimes am involved in as an artist as well. It's all part of that process for me. Just thinking of all of these friendships and all of these different people as a part of what it is to be an artist. Yeah.
Can you talk about any new projects, or do you have a sense of what your next book endeavor might be?
Well, I just finished this thing for Semiotext is going to be in the Whitney Biennial, and I just finished, they've asked 20 some of their artists to write books for them, and so I just finished a book on the Mexican drug war for them, and I just handed it in last week, and I'm working on a film right now with Michael Silverblatt and Chris Krause and Hedy Alcolti and a few other people as actors in the film. That my collaborations have grown into film, and that's what I'm doing now. So I'm making these films with all of these different people who are in my life as actors in them. And so that's what I'm working on right now. It'll be screened at the LA Art Fair in February, so I'm in a rush to do that. And I'm working on a couple of short stories right now. I used to write short stories and haven't done that in a while. So I'm working on a couple of short stories. And I have an idea for a novel, which is kind of loosely based on Alice in the Cities, that Wim Wenders film. So I have an idea, and I haven't started writing it. But I don't usually have an idea. I usually just start writing, and then it's a scary process. But here I have an idea. So
how interesting.
Yeah, I'm excited. Actually, it's a different way of working.
Yeah. Well, yeah, thank you so much for being on Between the Covers today, Veronica.
Thank you, David. This was great.
We've been talking today with Veronica Gonzalez-Pena, the author of The Sad Passions from Semiotext. You've been listening to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host, and I'll be back again next month with an interview with Gary Steingart about his new memoir, Little Failure.
It's time for the KBOO News at Noon for Thursday, December 19th. I'm Kristen Yount.
And I'm Nastasia Voisin. A sweeping amnesty bill passed by Russia's parliament may allow the Greenpeace